Beach with John Bout on www.tracksfm.org. John Bouts, John the Rage, all the on Tracks FM.
Kind of heaven on a golden rope. P.S. the Lord of Rage, Michelangelo from the dead, so he can make a fresh painting of my head. Then I hung out with a king and a queen, and the queen put me down with a polo team. The way I scored points all around the clock, I had a daughter, the princess, riding my jock. I knocked a freak off like a crazy retard, then I took a little trip into a deck of cards. The diamond jack joker and the ace of spades was amazed at Greta, her creator on the fade. Then I played cards with the queen of clubs. The queen of hearts and me cold fell in love. As for the queen of diamonds, she don't like me, because you know that a diamond is a girl's best friend. The double trouble spade was named the deuce, and the joker acted stupid, so he gave him the news. There was 52 cards and I met everyone. That story is over, but my rhyme ain't done. Then I took a trip to the center of the earth. I was kind of scared, so E-Love went first. I met these funny looking people, they called them squeezers, so I held them to my wallet like Ebenezer. Tight leather pants that'll make you grunt, two nice soft things right up front. The center of the earth ain't got no crime, just people body rocking to the LL rhyme. If you're kind of confused with what a skeezer is, it's just a girl who's on my jock, cause I'm in showbiz. There was a whole lot of skeezers, I dogged everyone. That story is over, but my rhyme ain't done. Woke up late one afternoon, realized I was in the world of cartoons. He-Man told me he beat me up, because he thought that I looked like a Donald Duck. Then I hung out with Spider-Man, he told me he was gonna start a comic strip band. The Incredible Hulk was gonna play the drum, Charlie Brown grabbed the guitar and started to strum. Snoopy tried to rock on the microphone, but Tom and Jerry both said he should leave it alone. Then I hung out with Mickey Mouse, he had two freaks, so we went to his house. Mickey's freak was ugly, but mine was deaf, so I knocked it off until there wasn't none left. They were cartoon characters, I met everyone. That story is over, but my rhyme ain't done. Since I'm a good friend of Father Time, I'm not getting older as I say this rhyme. I was warm in the snow at the Alamo before Bootshot Lincoln, I stole the show. I was down with George at the Delaware, but I wore a Kango, not the fake white hair. Me and E-Love met Sitting Bull, we made a peace pipe, then we took a pull. Then he brought more leaves from a golden chest. You thought it was tobacco? The shit was cess. There was a lot of great men, and I met everyone. That story is over, but my rhyme ain't done. 11:33, I swear it's no sooner. I went inside my TV, I met the Honeymooners. Ralph wanted me to bust a couple of rhymes, but I had my eyes on Alice's behind. Norton came down right about that time, looking in the front so we could swine and dine. Then I said to myself, I should give him a taste. So I pulled the microphone out my black briefcase. Said it ain't Bob Hope or Barry Manilow. Then I bought Norton's hat cause I forgot my Kango. Ralph said, I got a scheme, let me get to it. Norton, my pal, I said, yo, don't even do it. They were all Honeymooners and I met everyone. That story is over, but my rhyme ain't done. Cause my tongue was sharp, I hit a note with a harper, a harmonica, Veronica, I do my part. In a back room with leg room, I'm strong like a monsoon chilled in Maui Waui, and I carry my harpoon style. I'll smiling cause we got ill, wrote my name on a rock at the top of the hill. I surfed all the waves, made love in caves, and I kicked the ill beast to make the natives rave. Now I wanna tell you what all this means. From Farmers Boulevard to St. Albans, Queens, there's a lyrical technician who came to play. Number one B-boy, LL Cool J. All of this is just a story that I made up. Deaf lines will say on time, I'll cut creators' cuts. Some of it's fiction and some of it's fact. Not another common rap with a heavy drum track. A whole lot of rhymes and I wrote every one. That story is over and my rhyme is done.
Wow. Jeff, hopefully we'll get through a selection of the tracks tonight. John's picked them out, that particular one, and I can't believe that I've got that one on his album. I bought that album in 1987. But John's gonna, we're gonna have a little bit of a different show because it's John's show, so he'll pick out what he's gonna talk about. Sometimes it's not all that serious, sometimes it's stuff that's relevant to us. I think music is the subject of the day, but I'm gonna leave it to John. Take it away, John.
Hello. Yeah, thanks, mate. Yes, this week's subject, as I've titled it, is Loving Rap Music as a 1990s Teenage White Boy in the Suburbs. That's a bit of a mouthful, that title, but we'll give some reasoning behind it. So we're going to take a bit of a break from the ultra-serious stuff that we normally talk about here and reflect on some personal experiences. Now, this is not any kind of comprehensive history of rap music or hip-hop culture. This is just about how it affected my life and even begun my interest in political issues and social justice, particularly regarding race and culture. and also providing platforms for speaking and expression. It's going to be a little bit of a challenge for me. This subject was actually requested by someone close to me, and I don't normally take requests because you know, who the hell are you people to request what I do? But this one intrigued me, and I saw there were other depths making the subjects worth talking about, I think. However, it also involves talking about feelings and emotions, which is something I avoid at all costs because I find them disgusting. So I will struggle with articulating how things like music make me feel, but I'm going to do my best. So it's a bit experimental this week, listeners, but I hope you stick with us. This is no history, as I said, of hip-hop. We're not doing the Four Elements or who the greatest MC is or any of that kind of stuff. And it's certainly not a nostalgia trip because I despise nostalgia. Just a little slice of personal history and that hopefully allows us to discuss where we've come from and where we are now and, of course, where we're going. Or just me telling you about a load of great records. Starting with that one, which comes from the album Bigger and Deafer. It always starts with a record, doesn't it? My older brother bought this home at some point in the 80s, and the cover sleeve told me that the artist was some bloke named LL Cool J, sort of name I'd never seen before. Somehow I instantly knew that this picture and its inhabitant represented New York City in some way. Google the image if you haven't got it, you'll get the idea. The sound was like nothing I'd heard before, and yes, I know that's a cliche, but seriously, it really was. The loud pounding noise that I later learnt would be referred to as beats, with what my parents at the time would refer to as a shouty man, making rhymes over the top. These rhymes were about various aspects of living life as a young adult, beautiful women, and how awesome Mr. Cool J, or Mr. Smith as he was also known, actually was. As a kid, I would have run a mile from poetry, but I was kidding myself really, because as you can tell from the wordplay of my rhyme ain't done, it really was something quite profound and clever. A quick example, as you may have heard at the beginning: the president woke and he called the pope. The pope planted heaven on a golden rope. P.S. The Lord had to raise Michelangelo from the dead so he could make a fresh painting of my head. That lyric has stuck in my head literally since I was a little kid. And you know, everyone with rap music, we often talk about people doing the kind of bragging about how great they are, but that's an awesome brag. Come on, waking Michelangelo to make a painting of my head. I like that. My brother, after some pestering, put this album onto a cassette for me, and next to my Best of the Beach Boys, it rarely left my Walkman. Eventually, he got bored with the record, so I got that too. After that, I spent a good few years with no musical taste, just consuming pop radio and not really asking too many questions. I still pulled out Bigger and Deafer every so often, but no other kid that I knew in junior school could get their head around this stuff, so no doubt they didn't really care about it either, so I didn't really discuss it with others. I've always lived in suburbia, in an area that houses those who want very little out of life. They like things the same and are not into relating to difference. These are the sort of people that Heart FM and Magic were invented for. So I drifted around into other things. Our music was really just background. It just flowed off the radio or on TV. There was the odd song that I liked, but it didn't really have much of an effect on my life. And then I became a teenager. So now we're going to go into discussing Public Enemy, Fear of a Black Planet. Should we play it now, Dave, and then we'll talk about it afterwards?
You're picking some tunes here. I do apologise because we haven't rehearsed any of this here on John Bowes All the Rage, and it's something new we're trying out, I imagine. I mean, the thing with the presenters on Tracks FM, we don't tell them what to do and what to play. But John, I do concur, this is fantastic.
John Bouts, all the rage, all the on Tracks FM, Tracks FM, Tracks FM.
Fear of a Black Planet.
Man, don't you worry about a thing. How's your daughter? Nope, she's not my type.
But suppose she says she loves me.
All you're afraid of the mix of black and white. Living in a land where the mixing up race makes the blood impure.
Yeah.
She's a woman, I'm a man. Look at your face, I see you can't stand it. Put you down. Hey, come on, now.
Fight! I'm just a rhyme sayer. Skin protect against the ozone layer. Breakdown 2001. It might be best to be black or just brown. Countdown. Running, but they got me on the run. Treat me like I have a gun. All I got is jeans and chromosomes. Consider me black to the bone. All I want is peace and love on this planet. Ain't how that God planned it.
Yep, Fear of a Black Planet. The track Fear of a Black Planet. I do remember that particular album. I think it was probably one of the first rap groups' albums that they would release an album and it would go platinum. Never seen anything like it. It's different from Rapper's Delight and that sort of stuff. Rap went up a level with Public Enemy with its social messages. I don't think we'll see it again, personally. I really don't. And that was sampling the Barclays Holy Ghost. John, take it away.
Thanks, mate. Yes, indeed. Public Enemy. Walking to the train station one day, probably around about 1991 or 92, I saw a kid wearing a Public Enemy T-shirt. The T-shirt was the cover of the album Apocalypse 91, The Enemy Strikes Black, which, for those of you who have seen it, it is a black background with the Public Enemy logo in very garnish green on the front. The band are sitting around a skull in the middle with an army helmet on, with their security of the First World Group standing behind them. And the picture itself was a very powerful image, and it made me think I wanted to check. Not long after that, I saw the film Terminator 2, which was very big when I was a boy, and the character of John Connor wears a Public Enemy T-shirt all the way through the film. That was the classic off-angled logo. I cannot remember where I got my first album from, but it may have been from another kid in school who was one of the few people I knew who liked rap music. Not long after I bought Apocalypse 91, I then worked backwards towards the other albums. Now, Public Enemy's best albums are generally accepted to be It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back and Fear of a Black Planet, and I quite agree with that. They are amazing records. But Apocalypse 91 will always have a special place for me because it was my introduction to the harsh beats of the Bomb Squad's production that can still loosen your teeth if you turn them up loud enough, and the rhyming dominance of one Chuck D, who was unlike anyone I'd seen or heard before. The way he spoke, the way he tried to communicate directly, very controlled fierceness of the way he did things. As Dave said, we may not ever see the likes of them again. Well, we'll talk about that a little bit later. Well, you might be right. I might disagree with you. Anyway, I played this record very, very loud while researching the show, and it still sounds great, if not more politically relevant today, sadly. Next up would be Ice Cube with When Will They Shoot. And you know what, Dave, unless you want to add anything in, I'm ready to play that whenever you are.
John Bouts, all the rage, all the rage. On Trax FM, Trax FM, Trax FM.
Walking in my big black boots. Walking in my big black boots.
Goddamn, another rookie payback with a twist. The rookie on the shot, but the punk's missed. Ice Cube is outgunned. What is the outcome? Will they do me like Malcolm? Cause I bust styles, new styles, standing strong. While others run 100 miles, but a number one
and don't understand why you got an AK. Calling me an African American, like everything is parodied shit. Devil, you got to get this shit right. I'm black, blacker than a trillion midnight. Don't believe the hype was said and yet by the great Chuck D. Now they tryna fuck me with no Vaseline.
Cube, when will they shoot? I think I was talking to John. I used to work in record shops in different parts of the country, London. So I'd work Finchley, Hampstead, then I'd probably travel down to Kilburn one day, and Wembley, yeah, then Harrow, and the Predator album, Ice Cube, whatever parts of London, whether it be middle class, wealthy parents or whatever, everyone was buying Ice Cube. And I made a mistake, and I do apologise. I said I didn't think we'd see Public Enemy again, but do watch Professor Griff on YouTube. Professor Griff is part of Public Enemy. Fantastic insight or theories. And he ain't wrong. It may come out in a different package, but he ain't wrong. Do catch Griff on YouTube. John, take it away.
Thanks, mate. Yes, well, as I say, normally I don't tend to go for cliched terms, but what can we say outside of there's a lot going on in that song? Well, some absolutely amazing lyrics. If you want some things that relate directly to this show, I can't think of a line better than the KKK now wear three-piece suits, which is pretty much most of what we've talked about in the last few weeks. Yes, Ice Cube's album The Predator, that came from a very sharp turn for me in music, being about more than just nice tunes and lyrics about love. If you just to give you an idea, like if you imagine if you stick that on your earphones walking down the street as a teenage boy with not a hell of a lot else to say to the world. And that just pounding, intense sound comes out with that wonderful guitar loop too that makes it almost sound like a modern blues tune in some way, which arguably it was. Predator was probably the first overtly political album in some ways that I heard. It was full of anger at injustice, specifically the beating of Rodney King by four policemen who were later acquitted of the crime, and the LA riots that followed. If those riots had a soundtrack, this was definitely it. A historical document, according to one Mojo magazine writer when I was researching some of this. Written and performed by a man who at the time was only 23. He explained in an interview why he thought the riots were necessary in LA. He said, quote, "America doesn't hear pickets and protest singing. They just hear mass destruction," unquote. Now, that's worth remembering the next time you see Ice Cube and you think, that's the bloke from Are We There Yet and Anaconda, isn't it? Yeah. Anyway, Public Enemy, Ice-T and Ice Cube were the starting points for me and those who changed everything. In fact, at this point, it became apparent to me that this was my punk. It channeled rage and injustice, sometimes had a rather perverse sense of humour, and there are some gender attitudes that I would probably balk at these days in some of those early records, but ultimately it seemed to spark some part of my brain that was otherwise underfed. It altered my wardrobe too, as my t-shirt collection grew with many bands, logos and pictures from that world, plus I wanted a Raiders jacket. That would be the LA Raiders American football team. I've never actually had any interest in American football, but that didn't matter when I could get my hands on the great logo that I saw so many rappers wearing on those jackets. I had two of them in the end. Then there were the trainers, Jordans, Patrick Ewings, again, basketball players. Didn't really watch basketball, didn't have any interest in it, didn't care, just wanted the trainers. All consumer playthings that I wouldn't touch these days because I am, of course, a pure left-wing snowflake and I hate consumerism. But man, those trainers, they were good in the day. It was an awakening in my education and political interests too. Through the issue of censorship, around which this genre in general and specifically certain songs have often been victim of. The political censorship in the early 1990s was suffocating. In the UK, we regularly had media-lit moral panics about this film or that band or how they were going to help take society to hell, unlike our wonderful government, who were perfect. Things were banned all of the time, withheld and condemned, and we had very stuffy-looking people who seemed to have absolutely no relation to you, often showing up on television, telling you that this thing that you liked was very bad for you. In suburbia, you were supposed to stay in your place, or at least be so exceptional that when moving around, no one could stop you long enough to criticise you. Unfortunately, I wasn't one of those people. Every time I walked through London, on my way to HMV or Virgin Megastore, I would see people sleeping in the streets. When you turned on the TV, there were stories of the latest government official or MP who had been caught with his dick in someone who wasn't his wife, and this was actually during John Major's Back to Basics cultural campaign. Wow, we should probably talk about that 1 week. The LGBT community was struggling against fierce oppression, including within the law, where they were being just actively discriminated against. The NHS was getting bigger and bigger waiting lists, and the police were still a cesspool of racism. Yet apparently, in the UK, our biggest social problems were some angry black men from America making records with naughty words in them. I took all of this attempted censorship very personally, because I'd finally found something that I loved that spoke to me. And some bunch of conservatives were now trying to take it away, telling me, of course, that it was for my own good, which was even more insulting. Even at this time, when I did not understand social problems or even care that much, I was as much a teenager as anybody else, I could see that these cynical bastards were trying to evade attention coming down for their latest failures. Anti-censorship was my first political calling. Although I did not do that much actively, it certainly paved the way for the future. And certainly paved the way for me coming on this show, if no other reason, because I spent a lot of time yelling at people about why I thought this was a terrible thing. God, who knew, eh? Back in those days. In America, the culture war had raged since Ronald Reagan came in, and he and his fundamentalist Christian base had attempted to turn America back to the 1950s culturally. They hated alternative culture, and they fought it with various types of exclusion and even using the law. Infamously, Jello Biafra, the lead singer of the Dead Kennedys, went through a year-long trial for obscenity based on one of his albums, and that was pushed from very high up in the Senate at the time. Ice-T always courted trouble, not just for his depictions of women in his music, but also for treading a rather thin line between glorifying the gangster life that he had left behind and condemning the continually nihilistic life offered to black people on the streets. he certainly tried to show you could move on from that world in the way that that he had, and later the society he criticised tried to take him down. Which brings us on to Cop Killer. In 1992, Ice-T went on the road with his side project, a thrash metal band called Body Count. Along with Rage Against the Machine, this was responsible for the mixing of rap and rock, but we will forgive them for that because they didn't know what they were doing. Not least, we'll forgive Rage because they made some amazing music. And both bands managed to bring audiences together from two rather maligned musical genres, heavy rock and rap music. The inner harmony was not mirrored in the wider world, however, after Body Count released a protest song called Cop Killer, detailing a revenge fantasy in the wake of Rodney King's beating and how LA had exploded. As ever, government and conservatives looked for cultural figures to blame here rather than actually dealing with the issues that led to those riots in the first place. Dallas Police Association and the Combined Law Enforcement Association of Texas began what became a campaign against Warner Brothers Records to withdraw Body Count's self-titled debut album, which contained the song Cop Killer on it. Other police organisations across America joined in, and a call for Warner Brothers and the Time Warner record label to be boycotted grew. Even President Bush Sr. and Charlton Heston had a pop. It all got very nasty. I don't know if any of you have ever seen the video of Charlton Heston reading the lyrics of Cop Killer, but, oh, it's just brilliant. It's like Moses, you know, he who played Moses, standing there going, "And here are the lyrics. Die, 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 pig, die. Fuck the police. I know your family's grieving," but it's just, you've got to catch it on YouTube. It's so funny. It cheers me up every time I see it. Anyway, Ice-T defended his right to freedom of expression, saying that the record addressed racists in general, including parents and brutal police officers. God, I wonder why they didn't like him. Quote, "If those are my enemies, so be it," said Ice. A very smart and articulate man, actually. We're always well worth listening to. Again, before he, you know, just started acting in crappy TV series. Now, when researching this, I found a couple of people. I thought I had some very interesting points. There were two writers named Mark S. Hamm and Jeff Farrell who defended Ice-T, pointing out that American culture in general, and music in particular, had often celebrated criminals, including the likes of Pretty Boy Floyd, whose criminal career also included murdering law enforcement. Folsom Prison Blues has often been argued by many that made Johnny Cash the first gangster rapper. I shot a man in Reno just to watch him die. Then again, of course, you had Eric Clapton going to the top of the charts covering I Shot the Sheriff. No one was particularly bothered about him inspiring police-related violence. Ice-T stated that of Cop Killer, quote, "I'm singing in the first person as a character who is fed up with police brutality," unquote. On the song's subject matter of killing a policeman, he said, quote, "I felt like it a lot of times, but I never did it. If you believe that I am a cop killer, you believe David Bowie is an astronaut," unquote. Many artists backed him up. But this didn't matter to the establishment. With talk of him being charged with sedition and one story that the police began hassling his family that I heard, the song was eventually removed from the album. Today, of course, America has solved all of its problems with racist policing by simply being nice to law enforcement. So that was clearly the right move. My mind was now open from this point on to social justice or injustice, racism, different cultures and how they were treated in America and therefore quite often in this country too. I was hearing the voices of downtrodden people I'd never heard before anywhere else. Anytime I'd been with access to the media, and I was a very media-saturated young man, I didn't hear these voices. I couldn't work out why. Maybe somebody was afraid of something. There you go. Britain was also a more overtly racist country then, and this music and its language and the self-confidence of the mostly black practitioners scared a lot of people. It seemed to hold some of that early rock and roll threat that so much of rock music had forgotten about by that point. I also began to learn how embedded racist attitudes were in suburban England too, the usual stuff such as anyone black who was accused of a violent crime was always assumed to have done it. Meanwhile, I heard some of the same people lecturing me about how the crazed didn't really deserve the long sentences that they'd got. But for me, this music was untouchable. These words on these subjects made me think, and up to this point, music had never done that. I then had to face the once unthinkable prospect of it crossing over to the mainstream, too. So, if you want to jump in with anything, Dave, otherwise I'm ready for the next song.
I was just saying, John, you spoke a few shows ago about the British society, our British society, and how it should pride itself on soaking up other cultures. And I don't I do remember Radio 1 banning Frankie Goes to Hollywood.
Oh, I remember that.
Right, but I found radio, not the pirate radio, because we used to play everything. I found the mainstream radio and mainstream TV. Now, I remember ITV had, who remembers this kid's, Night Networks. And that was when 1987, we had five channels. And we then started to go 24 hours throughout the night. Because back in the day, TV used to finish at 12. Can you imagine that? And they put on a program called Night Network, and it had Tim Westwood on there, and it was, you'd see Ice Cube, you'd see Public Enemy, you'd see Run DMC, you'd see LL Cool J in their latest videos. I think this country has a, for all its crap, for all its UKIPers and its BNPs and its Farages and Tommy Robinson and all that, don't listen to them. This country has a huge reputation, something to be proud of playing music, playing what's happening, playing what's relevant, playing the music with messages. And apart from Frankie Goes to Hollywood, they played it. So what do you think of that, John? I mean, am I right? I mean, it has a lot more to be proud of than the doom and gloom immigrants taking our jobs.
Yeah, well, firstly, I'll come back to TV in a minute because I've got some specific things to say about that. That particular program you're referring to, I wasn't as familiar with. But certainly, as you say, I was familiar with the times when late night TV. I mean, listen, mate, I could talk for some time on a future show about late night TV and the days when Channel 4 used to show stuff that pissed people off and how much of a better channel it was when it did. And I'm not being nostalgic. I don't believe in nostalgia, but I can talk about things that aren't as good as they once were, or I think should be going in different directions. And that's a classic example. You know, I was thinking about this actually before I signed on for tonight's show. And, you know, just for the sake of younger listeners and also our international audience, Channel 4 used to be the alternative channel. And, you know, if you can think of like quite an obscure film director from Russia or India or somewhere in South America or somewhere in Asia, Channel 4 almost certainly did a season of that person's films at some point. That's the kind of thing they would do. And you would tune in and you would find different odd culture like you're talking about here. And I think because it was on later at night, maybe people didn't mess with it so much. They weren't that bothered. I mean, the crossover, as we're about to hear with this next song by Cypress Hill, absolutely that made a difference. That's what, as soon as white suburban kids started listening to it, that's when really all the trouble started. Before that, they couldn't have given a shit if urban black youth were listening to music and how negative it was or anything else. You know, that didn't bother them. But yeah, it's absolutely, these are the things we do best. So for instance, giving a platform to something that's not being played someplace else. Why not? Who cares where it comes from? It doesn't matter. So yeah, I think you got a good point there. Anyway, should we get insane?
All the rage. All the on Tracks FM. Tracks FM. Tracks FM.
1993, Cypress Hill. They've got a Facebook page, Cypress Hill, and it's just all about smoking weed. But it's all in good fun, isn't it? We were talking about Channel 4, actually, and there was two programmes that probably changed British TV, and it was the place to... One was called The Tube. One was called yes. The Tube, and they... one of their first shows in 1986 was... they had Mantronics on there, which was incredible. Another show, they had DJ Cheese and Word of Mouth. Another one was... there was a huge rumour here that among... Luther Vandross had AIDS because he lost a lot of weight, and there was a time, and we would have just thought that, and they actually asked him live on air. He had an exclusive interview on Channel 4. It was amazing, really good stuff. And of course Solid Soul, who could forget? So they're very tame by all accounts, but still it was aired on Channel 4. John, take it away.
Yes, thanks, mate. Some writers have in fact called 1993 the best year for rap music. Now, I have no idea if that is a provable fact, but I can say that Cypress Hill's album Black Sunday came out, and for a year it was never far from my Walkman. I remember buying it in the hour price in Falmouth, which is down in Cornwall. Insane in the Brain was already out and had crossed over, more or less, to a wider, more mainstream audience. Radio 1 had played a cleaned-up version of it, and even Capital FM played it a few times when it charted in the top 40. The night before coming on that particular holiday, Tim Westwood's Capital Rap Show, which started around midnight, if I remember rightly, had played the soon-to-be follow-up single, I Ain't Going Out Like That. That turned out, in fact, to be the third single, I think. And it sounded amazing again, rough, urgent, like people on the edge. Like Ice-T's work, this was frontline reporting from the ghetto, where gang war was a way of life and police were never there to protect you, only attack you. Cypress Hill also had the best t-shirts. Go do a Google image search or whatever other search. Yeah, fuck Google, do another image search. The 2 weeks from hearing that song and the release of that album seemed like months. Do you remember that, Dave, when like the amount of time between something being released really, really built up, and it felt like... I heard that song and it was... I knew when the album was coming out. And it was like, oh my God, I've got to hear this stuff. I have to hear it now.
Yeah, I mean, it's totally changed. When I was coming up, we'd have to queue. So when there was a certain record, say in 1984, we had Paul Hardcastle's... Paul Hardcastle was a British artist, and he released a track called Rainforest. And these were the days where we were queuing up outside the record shop. I don't think we'll see that again. I must be an idiot. Yeah. Take it away, John.
Yeah. Coming on to UK TV, that was a pretty empty place as far as rap music was concerned at that time, with the exception of a couple of the bits that Dave mentioned. There was the odd thing on BBC Two, which was also the first place I saw Ice-T, in fact, but this was still, in a manner of speaking, underground. And then there was The Word. Literally, in this case, after The Tube came The Word. The early 1990s youth programme on Channel 4 of a Friday night. Back when this channel, as I said, used to screen things that were different and sometimes even challenging their content. The Word was frankly a complete pile of shit, a cocktail of awful presentation. Oh, it was, you know it was. Awful presentation, brain-dead audiences and uncomfortable guests quite often. But it did have very two things that were very attractive to a teenage boy. For starts, there was a chance of possibly seeing some nudity, because they used to do a lot of covers of, you know, porn stars and things like that, lots of features, and music artists who were not normally on other programs. To give you an idea, this was the first place we saw Nirvana, their first UK live TV performance, a truly incendiary one by Manic Street Preachers, and equally one by Rage Against the Machine. I couldn't find the Manics one. I think the full episode of The Word that's on is online, but I couldn't find the singular one. But I watched Nirvana again last night when I was researching this show. I watched Rage Against the Machine doing Killing in the Name Of, and my God, it's... You just have to see it, folks. Really, it's amazing. It's this small studio, this small audience. You can't even see Zach's face properly. He's covered in, you know, the way he's angled his hair and stuff. And he's just yelling this, and the band are just going for it. And it seems quite claustrophobic, but it's amazing. And then there's Chris Eubank sitting on the couch watching it, because he was the next artist up. It's just an amazing show. They also had a performance by... they did features, and we saw a feature on Ice-T there with relaxing at home with his gun collection. We saw the band Onyx nearly starting another riot, which they'd done earlier in the week at one of their London shows. Well, a riot had occurred, I'm not saying they started it. And we also had the great sight of seeing Snoop Doggy Dogg being attacked by Rod Hole and Emu. Do you remember that? Rod?
Well... Yes. That is a YouTube... apparently it's one of the most YouTube clips... But I must say about the Wii, yeah, it is. Because it's God, you go. But there was one relevant bit. Mark Lamar was actually, not Terry Christian, Mark Lamar was actually presenting, and I think it was relevant, and he challenged Shabba Ranks.
I remember, yeah.
Shabba Ranks had a record out called Boom Bye Bye in a Batty Man's Head. Now, what happened within West Indian, Jamaica, Guyana, Trinidad, there probably is a homosexual community there. But West Indians tend to disregard it. They won't have it. And Mark Lamar challenged Shabba Ranks. And I think Shabba Ranks, who was signed up to Sony Records at that time, and he had a big career, Mr. Loverman and all that, the minute he went on Channel 4 and Mark Lamar confronted him and told him, you're wrong, you're fundamentally wrong in what you're saying and singing about, Sony, and I think his career, certainly on the mainstream, went downhill. So some respect, the word was quite good that way, John.
To be fair, yeah, I mean, I'm being a bit snotty about it, but you're right, it was just some of it. God, it was awful. Some of the presentation, the shit they used to do. But anyway, but you, as I say, you watched it. You didn't really, you know, some people might out there be thinking, why didn't you just tape it? Well, because if you taped it and watched it the next day, there's a chance your parents could walk in on you watching something that you weren't supposed to. See, again, this was the days when things were a bit forbidden. And just coming back on that, yeah, I remember, if I remember right, it was actually the song was actually Bougie Banton, and they did a feature about it. They did a feature on Jamaica, and Shabba Ranks was in the studio, and they came back.
Yeah, sorry, John. I stand corrected.
I know, I don't want to be moody, or I just want anyone, you know. But no, he and Shabba Ranks defended it, saying, you know, the Bible talks about crucifying homosexuals. And Mark Lamar came back in and said something along the lines of, what absolute load of crap, you know perfectly well it doesn't say in the Bible, how dare you? Or something like that. It was really impressive to see him do it, actually. And then just moved on to the next thing. As I've had enough of this. I just moved on, which I did quite like. You know, you wouldn't get out on the BBC. Anyway, so moving on from that, yeah. After on our point of proving that the stuffed bird emu was absolutely a badass gangster, we proved that. This stuff was really, again, it was exciting, it was a bit forbidden, and it pissed off the establishment, which was all good by me. Snoop's visit to the UK had been a cause of contention, as he was under suspicion at the time of being involved in a fatal shooting back in LA. The day after his appearance, one of our lovely tabloids, I believe it was The Sun, carried a front page mugshot of him, which was touched up to make him look extra sinister, and it actually had this headline, "Kick this evil bastard out." Many of my favourite artists were dismissed by those around me as being scum, etc. at the time. So anyway, other than that, when you got hold of Sky, which we eventually did, you had MTV back in the days when they actually used to play music, and then when they actually eventually used to play rap music. So some of you may remember Yo MTV Raps, which was on daily at one point with presenters Ed Lover and Dr. Dre, that would be the DJ, not the other one, around 4:30, 5 o'clock. I remember coming home from school to see it. Really look forward to it. They used to play a lot of videos, plus some interviews and a few live performances. Highlights included artists like Public Enemy, Cypress Hill. It was when I first saw Cypress Hill, actually, their first album, Hand on the Pump. Here is Something You Can't Understand, How I Could Just Kill a Man. Diggable Planets were on there. Lords of the Underground, House of Pain, The Far Side, Eric B. and Rakim. Does anyone remember the Lords of Flatbush? I think I'm the only person who remembers the Lords of Flatbush. Eric Sermon doing the song Stay Real. That was a good tune. Anyway, some of these artists at the time I didn't even like that much, but it still opened my mind to difference, and a lot of them I ended up liking today. I didn't quite get the Far Side when I was a kid. Now I do. On Saturday mornings, you had a double whammy of a version of the first show, then followed by Fab Five Freddy doing specials and interviews with particular artists, again playing lots of videos. And it opened my mind. I got to hear another side of life from misfits and outsiders broadcasting from the front lines of a different world. I got to see and hear how smart and articulate these artists were while the rest of the world around me was dismissing them and their chosen form of expression, and of course doing so because the majority of them were black. About this time, I was allowed to go up London, as we used to say, without parental supervision, which meant I could walk the stretch between Bond Street and Tottenham Court Road and visit both HMV stores and Virgin Megastore. And this is where I found albums that I'd read about but never actually seen. In those days, we had no suburban HMVs. Your local record shop would order something in, which in its own way would make it even more precious. Like, you wouldn't even see it until it showed up. And I remember very clearly the sudden rush of seeing all these albums lined up on the wall or lined up in the CD racks. often for the first time, or going upstairs to the video section, where all of the concerts and weird tie-ins were lined up along the wall. You had some great Public Enemy videos, many of which have been converted to DVD now, so you can still get them. And they're also, you know, very educational. You had some of Ice-T's ones, which were really just kind of strangely funny or tough. And he had actually a whole of his classic, and without doubt, I think, his best album, OG, Original Gangster, was put onto a video, which I remember seeing. Now, talking about the reaction of society, my love of this music, as I've mentioned a couple of times, was not a socialising activity. In fact, it was quite isolating. Funnily enough, while music is often about finding your tribe and is usually something that grows your contact base and friends base, I had very few friends who shared my love of this music, and those that I did were not exactly close. I didn't share it with many people at all, in fact. The roughness, the subject matter, the language put most people off, I think, and my convert's mindset meant that I was actually pretty fundamental about my tastes. I was a fan of rap music and nothing more. Well, almost nothing more. The odd song used to turn my head, such as sometime around this point I heard Talking Heads' Psycho Killer, which was one of those, okay, I like this song, but I don't like any other kind of rock music. That didn't last very long, but there you go. I like all that stuff now. It was a soundtrack to my world that I was dealing with here, and it was nothing to do with those around me. Head down, earphones on, fuck everything. That was my attitude then. There was a lot of intolerance towards me for liking this music. Someone told me that Public Enemy were a, quote, pro-black band, which apparently was a bad thing. And there were some near punch-ups, and I was often told that I was a traitor to my race, which is one of my favourites. My kinship with arseholes has always been fairly minimal at best, so this wasn't a betrayal that bothered me very much. And these sorts of people, yeah, they never change. They're the same. I still see some of them now. They're still around here. They've always had this attitude. Stay in your box, don't look for anything different, for fear that you might find something better, and pull yourself out of the shithole that you live in, or even become creative yourself, which is not for the likes of us. You know, this music was so powerful for someone like me who just had such a crap time at school and didn't really achieve anything, for it to kind of say, but not that I was going to be a rhymer, but it just said, look, a lot of people here didn't do too well in the conventional world. You know, if you see Straight Outta Compton, you know, you see the Ice Cube writing lyrics on the bus, you know, that's the idea. I thought, oh wow, no, you can do this. You can just do your thing. You just have to start from, in that sense, like I said earlier, it was like punk, you know, it was anyone can do this, anyone can do anything, just, you know, just get out of your box. One particular memory I have is, again, a family holiday to Cornwall. We were driving out of the Exeter service station. I was wearing the Public Enemy t-shirt that I had, one of my many, which was the Apocalypse 91 cover. I finally found it. There were two kids about my age in the car next to me, and they were giving me this most disgusted look, which really still makes me laugh now when I think about it. And they seemed to actually be repulsed by my t-shirt. Or the idea of this white boy wearing such a thing across his chest. Then again, they might have been highly literate music critics who thought that Apocalypse 91 just wasn't a good enough album worthy of a t-shirt. You never know. I'll never know these days. There was also a notion that this music was old. Many of you listeners might also remember in the early 1990s, you had to be up with the new, down with the new, whichever way you want to look at it. You know, records, literally, by the time I got hold of a song, there would be someone telling me that it was too old, and I should move on to the next thing. I couldn't keep up. But I got all this music through my own endeavour. Almost never heard it at any other person's house, and aside from borrowing the odd album and the odd track that popped up on the radio or through the, as I say, MTV Raps or The Word, I couldn't find it otherwise. It was all stuff I had to save up for, too. You'd often read something in Hip Hop Connection magazine and then go down the local record shop and order it. It made hip-hop seem quite exclusive, actually. Regardless of my opinions, it just seemed hard to get hold of. I was not really a concert goer in my youth, so I never saw any of my favourite artists live until years later when I saw Public Enemy. I was well into my adulthood, and I had a hugely diverse musical palette by that time, but they were still urgent and intense after all these years, and it was well, well worth the wait. But just as quickly as all this was built, it began to fall apart. Now, we are coming to near the end of the show. I still had a couple of things I want to talk about, but I don't mind, Dave. If you don't mind, we'll do this in two parts, and I'll come back to this next week if you like.
Yeah, absolutely, John. Yeah. I'm gonna. I thought one. I read this next one, and I thought I'd just play this for you because it. What happened? Public Enemy had released a single called "Rebel Without a Pause," which actually just broke. Just smashed the whole whole world up to bits. It had never been done before, which is an odd record.
It's such a tune.
EPMD came out and changed it. So Public Enemy needed to change things, and they came out with this record. And I think they played this to Run DMC at the time. And Run DMC said, what the hell is this? What is this? And it just blew Rebel Without a Pause. Even as hip-hop DJs, which I was back then, we used to cut this record to bits. It just... And then we found all the breakbeats. It was Fred Wesley and James Brown and stuff. But thank you very much, John. I look forward to the second part of the show. Yeah, we're going to play out with this beauty. Thank you very much, John.
You're welcome, man. Thanks for having me on again. I appreciate it. Play some tunes, people.
John Bouts, all the rage, all the rage. On Tracks FM, Tracks FM, Tracks FM, Tracks FM.
Yo, Chuck, what's the move, man? I was on my way up here to the studio, you know what I'm saying? And this brother stopped me and asked me, yo, what's up with that brother Chucky D? He's way nice. I said, yo, the brother don't swear he nice. He knows he's nice, you know what I'm saying? So, Chuck, I got a feeling you turned into a public enemy, man. Now, remember that line you was kicking to me on the way out to L.A. Lounge in Queens while we was in the car on the way to the shop? Well, yo, right now, kick the bass for them brothers and let them know what goes on.
What goes on? Well, kid, put it up on the board. Another rapper shot down from the mouth that roared. 1, 2, 3, down for the count. The result of my lyrics, oh yes, no doubt. Cold rock rap, 49ers supreme is what I choose and I use. I never lose to a team, cause I can go solo like a Tyson photo. Make the fly girls wanna have my photo. Run in a room, hang on the wall. In remembrance that I rock them all. Suckers, ducks, so hump MCs.
The Rage with John Bowd on www.tracksfm.org.